Hello, you're listening to New England Climate Conversations, the podcast all about the impacts of climate change and how we can make a difference. I'm your host, Owen, and for this episode, we've interviewed John Stein, the owner of Fogtown Brewing Company here in Ellsworth, Maine. Fogtown is a brewery with a commitment to sustainable practices, including utilizing brewing byproducts to reduce waste and using solar panels to meet most of the company's energy needs. But first, we'll get into this week's Climate Bites, our rapid-fire segment about recent major climate events. I'll turn it over to Luna to start.
Grapevines are incredibly climate-sensitive crops, and as such are a special case to observe for climate change-related impacts. The industry, worth over $300 billion, has been subject to erratic weather patterns, hail, drought, wildfires, all which upset the delicate balance needed for healthful plants to grow. Like many crops, the first buds appear more than 2 weeks earlier than in the 1970s. Ripening starts about 3 weeks earlier. These patterns produce smaller grapes that result in sweeter, more boozier wines. The current trend, however, is lighter and more dry wine. A critical problem is the water supply to these wineries. Wineries, particularly smaller ones, are turning to time-tested regenerative and biodiverse practices. These include cover crops and providing for the proliferation of diverse fauna life. Other wineries are locating operations at higher altitudes, which provide cooler temperatures and fewer heat waves. And now, coffee and climate news. Over to you, Corbin.
Coffee, that delicious dark brown drink which caffeinates much of the world alongside black tea, is facing difficult conditions. Habitat loss for key pollinators is one of the many factors contributing to reduced output and higher prices. As coffee is primarily produced in tropical environments, this sensitive system is first to see the damage from climate change impacts. Furthermore, disease and pesticides make the populations harder to sustain. Deforestation and land loss will shrink coffee population by nearly half over time. Consider that this is with the 1.5 degrees Celsius increase, an amount that human climate goals are expected to fall short of avoiding. Extreme climate events like droughts and landslides can devastate the amount of land available to grow these beans. Coffee processing amounts to about 50% of the industry's greenhouse gas emissions. Coffee is set to increase in price for the moment as the industry is scrambling to adjust to these conditions. The flavor profile and quality are changing as well. The beans are slightly more acritic and less acidic and vibrant. Experimental research is resulting in drought and disease-resistant varieties of coffee plants, along with increasingly educated labor practices, is at the forefront of heading off some of the more deleterious effects of climate change. Next, I'll pass it over to Owen for a piece on chocolate and climate change.
Much like coffee, chocolate beans face the same intricacies of delicate growing conditions, labor problems, and consumer demand-side hostility. Output declines number in the millions to tens of millions of metric tons due to harsh and volatile growing conditions, which leave these vulnerable to illnesses like cocoa swollen shoot virus disease, a recent series of infestations in the African continent's cocoa growing regions. This virus-induced illness has increased in prevalence by 88% over 6 years. Rising temperatures in Africa's cocoa belt produce a supermajority of the world's cocoa beans. Climate change has reduced crop yields by up to 50%. Lands best suited to cocoa growing are estimated to be halved over a short period of time. Price increases usually do not result in better living conditions for those at the growing and processing phases of chocolate production. Like coffee bean growers, some are choosing to leave the industry, unable to shoulder the diminishing returns of their labor. Additionally, climate-resilient strains are being researched and implemented with the intention of being able to weather erratic rainfall, varying disease vectors, and increased heat waves. This has been New England Climate Conversations Climate Bites.
Hello, can you please introduce yourself and your history with Fogtown?
Sure, my name is John Stein. I live here in downtown Ellsworth. Started Fogtown with a friend just about 6 years ago. And since then, I've been running Fogtown. I'm now the owner and also member of City Council here in Ellsworth.
Nice. So how has climate change affected the microbrewing industry, and are those effects different from what large operations would experience?
It's a great question. Yes, the climate change has affected all the industries, I think, you know, across the globe. Small breweries see a lot of effects because we are both distributing wholesale beer as much as possible around the state, out of state, but also we're selling directly to people. So we see it on a sort of direct-to-consumer tap room scale, but we also see it on a more broad wholesale scale. So when we're talking wholesale, the effects tend to trickle down from sourcing ingredients, things like the barley and the hops that we use in the beer, but also the water that is the main ingredient in beer, which we get from Ellsworth City Municipal Water Source, but also the other packaging materials like the aluminum from the aluminum cans, carbon dioxide that we use to carbonate the beer and to move the beer around different tanks. So we've seen all kinds of weird stuff happen, both from results of the pandemic, but also climate change results. Things like getting very difficult to source carbon dioxide, not being able to source aluminum from cans and having to get it from other sources, seeing hugely increased shipping costs because of the cost of fuel, water shutoffs when water mains here break downtown or when we're worried about runoff from stormwater. And then closures, from excess rain, everything from the weather conditions day to day. So if we get too much rain, it actually flows into our building. We'll also, days that are too cold, we won't see people because they won't come out to the garden. Days that are too hot in the summer as well make it difficult for people to sit outside when they used to be able to.
Yeah.
So we're seeing weather results. We're also seeing sourcing and especially since we use a lot of main grown ingredients, we're seeing a lot of price fluctuations and it being increasingly difficult to grow things like the barley that we use in our beer.
Yeah. So how is Fogtown addressing their own impact?
Well, we're looking for more locally sourced ingredients. So everything from the ciders and wines that we make from local fruits. I'm partnering with local growers like Blue Barrens, Blueberry Farm and Cherryfield, where we're actually using their leftover or winnowed blueberries that they would otherwise compost. We're actually getting those for free from them and putting them back into the value-added system. So composting them is great, but also if we can turn those into a value-added wine and sell that, that's great for us. We're using a rustic-grown barley more and more, so some of our beers are 100% main ingredients, some of them are only 50%, but all of our beers have Maine barley. So it is difficult to grow it in Maine, but farmers are increasingly using it as cover crop and using brewing varietals as well. And we save a lot on shipping costs, and we know that it is better to get it, directly from Maine rather than having it shipped overseas from Europe.
Yep.
And then for energy, we installed a 17.4 kilowatt system photovoltaic solar on our roof. So that covers about 70% of our energy usage, which most of our energy goes to cooling the product. So in the summer when the sun is shining and our refrigerators are calling for cooling, we're getting a lot of that energy back from the sun.
Nice. All right. Any interesting changes in flavor profiles or new products that have gotten great community feedback?
Yeah. There are a few that feature local ingredients. The stud wall, people have liked that, uses spruce tips that will go and tip them in the springtime when it's tipping season. So tourists really like that because they get to taste a little bit of like the spruce, the local foraged flavors, which is exciting to talk about. We also use oysters from Long Cove Sea Farm in Deer Isle for our oyster saison. So again, that's sort of featuring these local agriculture and aquaculture products that we can talk about. Hey, it's local, it's done right here, it's a sustainable practice, and check out these other small businesses doing good work. Ciders as well. We got our cider program up and running a few years back, and that features a ton of locally foraged fruits. So that's me and some friends going out and picking apples from either heritage trees in people's backyards that they don't pick from, or wild trees in parks and things. So we get permission from the owners, but we then get to harvest fruits that would otherwise fall, be eaten by deer, just ferment on the ground or compost. So we're, like the blueberries, putting those back into the value-added system. And the only carbon footprint that takes really is the fuel that I put in the truck to go fill the truck bed with apples. If that, sometimes I'm walking and filling bags, or people will bring bags of apples to us from their backyards. So that's really exciting.
Nice. So I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, but what kind of distribution do you have, and how does that tie into sustainability metrics?
We have three different types of distribution. Four really. One is that we sell right to people who come to the bar, so beer on tap. That is our highest margin sale, meaning it costs the least to make it, and we can make the most money off of that. That's how most small breweries are making most of their money, is direct sales to people. It also is the least impactful on the environment. It's just, you know, we're not using packaging ingredients. It goes right in a keg, right on tap, right into a glass that we wash and reuse, which we love to do. We also self-distribute, meaning we load up our van and drive to local restaurants and shops. We'll deliver cans, we'll deliver kegs, and those will go on tap. We love doing that as well, because we get to work with other local small businesses and restaurants, and we get to sort of pass on that word of mouth description, of our products. So we get to talk to bartenders and say, try this, it has spruce tip in it. Here, do you get these flavors? And then the bartenders can tell either year-round people or tourists, say, this is actually made right down the street from you, and it uses ingredients from the park or from, we're not supposed to pick stuff from the national park, but but it has those sort of Acadian flavors. And then thirdly, we sell to distribution companies who bring our cans and kegs around the state of Maine. So down to Portland, up to Aroostook County, and everywhere in between. Which, because we live in a small town, we don't have people coming in all winter, not too many people. So in order to keep staff and keep people working so that, you know, they stick around for the high season, we continue production, we put stuff in cans, we sell it to distributors, and they're bringing it around the state. And lastly, we sell to a distributor down in the Boston area, because they can buy enough volume of product to sort of justify us making enough of it in the winter to keep staff on. It's sort of this necessary thing that we do to be able to churn out enough volume to keep the lights on, but it's harder. The margins are narrower with distribution, and it uses a ton of energy. It takes a lot of aluminum packaging material, it takes a lot of carbon dioxide to move the product around, labeling, you know, we're printing on some plastic labels. So there's a lot of waste created relative to the on-tap sales. So that's something that I'm always thinking about and juggling, and we're looking to decrease our use of plastic and decrease our use of packaging material as much as possible. But that's the struggle and the juggle on a year-to-year basis.
Yep. All right. Are you or do you plan on making a carbon-neutral beer?
That's really hard. There are some large breweries that recapture CO2. I brought a tour group from College of the Atlantic in. They always bring their fermentation classes and sometimes their cider classes by the brewery to see how things are made. And one student last year asked, how much carbon dioxide is produced by the fermentation in your brewery? You know, for each batch that you make, which I didn't have an answer for. I had to go back to the lab and do some chemistry and stoichiometry equations and figure it out, and it's a lot. It's, you know, each time we brew, say, a Night Nurse, which is our stout that we produce in a 500-gallon vat, it's making, you know, the equivalent of the CO2 that would be released by burning, you know, 5 to 10 gallons of gasoline. So, not a huge amount, but enough that it's appreciable, and it's something we think about. Our fermentation is actually pushing CO2 out into the environment. At the same time, we're using CO2, and wouldn't it be great if we could reclaim it? the equipment to do that is hugely expensive, and yeah. Some breweries have developed that program, and it's incredible. You know, breweries are, if they can afford it, they are often sort of a beacon of something to strive for small breweries. But on that scale, it makes it tough. So instead, I've gone more toward the locally sourcing ingredients and putting stuff on tap as much as possible. Mm-hmm. The ciders as well are a good example. If we can do an all foraged cider fermented in the oak barrels that we use every year, put it on tap, that's about as close as we can get, which, you know, I said is a couple tanks of gas to go pick up the apples and some electricity to mill them up and press them. But other than that, that's, you know, aside from solar offsets and you know, carbon credit offsets, I think that's about as close as we get.
Well, it's understandable. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, prohibitively expensive equipment involved. Mm-hmm. Do you have any last comments? Anything you didn't get to touch on that you'd like to?
Well, I have an interesting vantage point being on city council, and I've noticed over the last few years, you know, I sort of mentioned larger breweries act as this sort of beacon of community and ways for other smaller breweries to strive to do better, both at, you know, employee management to, you know, ecological, sustainable practices. And we've found that just being in the community, having a beer garden, having beers on tap, brings a lot of connections to us. So nonprofits like Downey's Community Partners, Frenchman Bay Conservancy, Island Heritage Trust, all of these conservation groups have worked with us in a really collaborative way over the last 5 years, from just doing fundraisers in the beer garden to actually creating beers together. For example, Frenchman Bay had their volunteers pick a bunch of huckleberries years ago, and then we made a huckleberry ale. Proceeds went back to that organization as fundraising. Island Heritage Trust, their volunteer crew went out all over Deer Isle and picked a bunch of apples, brought them back, and they went into a totally foraged Deer Isle cider that we did. Same thing, proceeds went back. So not only highlighting those organizations, but in the process, being able to talk with them about the conservation work that they're doing has been a really special part of growing the brewery here. And then on the other side, my role with the city council, it's been a really useful education. So I sort of know of all of these different groups pushing for good environmental practices and conservation that I, you know, feel honored I'm able to take some of that information and work to city council and work for, you know, hopefully change on a small municipal level.
Yeah. Well, that's actually really interesting, the collaboration with the, you know, people foraging stuff and bringing it to you. I didn't know about that. So, all right, that was that's the interview, and
cool.
Awesome. That's all for this week's episode. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and share it with your friends. Also, if there are any topics you would like us to cover in the future, feel free to reach out via social media or leave a comment on our YouTube channel. See you next week.